This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
This podcast is brought to you by Maine Operation Game Thief, New Hampshire Wildlife Heritage Foundation, and International Wildlife Crime Stoppers. This podcast is brought to you in part by Sovereign Sportsman Solutions. As conservation officers, we know just how important technology is in this day and age. S3 is a cutting-edge and trusted vendor that provides state agencies with licensing, mobile, CRM, marketing, law enforcement, and event management solutions all in one place. They are dedicated to benefiting the resource, so check out the link in the show notes to sign up for their newsletter and get the industry insights, news, and content that can keep you up to date on the tech that helps drive conservation into the future. A Game Warden's children's book, titled A Cowboy in the Woods, is a story of Bobby, a boy who spends the whole summer observing wildlife, writing notes in his notebook, fishing with his dad, and keeping track of all the animals in his neighborhood. While trying to solve a neighborhood mystery, what he discovers is more than just an appreciation for the natural world. The idea for this book came from Wayne Saunders' own childhood experiences, growing up and exploring the woods and streams and lakes and ponds of his native New Hampshire. The love of nature instilled in his childhood led him to a career as a conservation officer. Wayne Saunders is a retired lieutenant conservation officer from the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department. Lindsay Webb is a naturalist, wildlife biologist, and environmental educator. Together, they collaborated with wildlife artist Ashley Mayers to produce The Cowboy in the Woods, the story of a boy whose love of nature leads him in unexpected directions. Available at wardenswatch.com and Amazon. Listen to the Thin Green Line podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Game Wardens John Norris and Wayne Saunders talk about wildlife, the outdoors, law enforcement, environmental subjects mixed with current events and guests that are part of the Thin Green Line. And if you are one of those visual people, like me, for $5 a month, you can see the actual podcast on Patreon.com. Just search the Thin Green Line podcast on Patreon.com and join us.
We love our children. We protect them. We guide them. We prepare them for life in the world. With all that we do, from deep in our hearts, we cannot control all things. Life-threatening illnesses and disabilities affect far too many of our children each year. While we cannot change the circumstance, we can make dreams come true. Dreams to provide hope, to provide spiritual healing and strength, to provide moments of happiness and relief in the hardest of times. We can give a glimmer of light and hope in a time of darkness and despair. Join huntofalifetime.org to help make dreams come true, to provide hope for children with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Hunt of a Lifetime is a nonprofit organization fulfilling dreams for hunting and fishing trips to youth 21 and under with life-threatening illnesses and disabilities. Visit huntofalifetime.org to learn how you can make a difference.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers,
Wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.
Warden's Watch, episode 65. For this episode of Warden's Watch, we are going to talk about the Colebrook, and sometimes it's coined as the incident, the Colebrook incident, and I'm going to call it the Colebrook murders. To coin it a little bit better, we're going to be able to talk to Richard Carey, the author in That Evil Day that kind of puts the Colebrook murders all together. I was involved in that. I was shot in the line of duty during that. We'll get into that. And that's what this mini series of podcasts is going to do. But before we do that, I always like to reach out to you guys and just let you know that the way to help us is to give us a good review on the Apple Podcasts. That helps other people know that it's a good podcast and to listen. Interesting. 5-star rating on that helps us, as well as, you know, John, you have a great book, The Hidden War Out. I have a kid's book out now. So all on wardenswatch.com. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's good. And guys, we do appreciate, you know, you guys listening in. And we've had a lot of people outside of the traditional fingering line conservation officer, genre, if you will, tune in and really enjoy both podcasts known under the Warden's Watch umbrella. And yeah, Wayne, your children's book is spot on. I've moved a bunch over here in the Northwest and the West Coast just because the cool thing about a children's book is you're paying it forward at an early age. You know, I mean, we all know my story of having never met a game warden until I was already in college and along the way. And I could have saved a lot of time and had the right major in college at first. Had I met a game warden or been tutelaged on what they even were as a young boy, because I would have jumped at it. I mean, obviously, it was the calling for both of us. So this book is cool. It's going to be a series, right, Wayne? So we're going to have stories as they develop, as Cowboy in the Woods kind of grows into, well, we won't be a spoiler alert, but I think we know where he's probably going to go. Mm-hmm. And where it goes, but it's a fun book. And yeah, you know, now that we're, you know, melded onto Warden's Watch podcast under one umbrella with the website, you can get all of our books there. We've got Hidden War, my book, we've got, you know, Cowboy in the Woods series, we can throw up some more in the woods, we've got the V-Knife Signature Blades, the Folders, the Trailblazer, and now this fall by Christmas we're gonna have all my fixed blades, and we're gonna just, you know, put fingering line packages for conservation savvy folks up on the website to be available in addition to all this podcast content. So we're grateful, guys, for you guys tuning in and help us spread the word.
Yeah, and I can't help but as I watch the news, John, and see all the stuff going on the border and cartel using this border issue to exploit us. And I always think of your book because the cartels were here growing in your tenure and even more so now. So, you know, if you guys haven't read Daron's book, you really need to get it and find out what was going on then. And then times that by 10, isn't it true, John? I mean, it's even more so now than then.
Yeah, Wayne, unfortunately, it's blown up since COVID. And the other thing that's happened just in this last week is I've been hit up by, I think it's 5 national news sources now for feedback on water stealing. And right now, California, you know, my old home state, the Golden State, is coming into one of the most significant droughts we've had. And, you know, it's kind of deja vu from 2014 to 2016 when Met was brand new, when we were in our state's largest drought in over a century. And now some primary bandits responsible for stealing all that water, especially in drought conditions, which, you know, just debilitates any state, any waterway, any, wildlife, aquifer, et cetera. Now we're having another one. So I was speaking with CNN, Washington Post, and various other news channels, not only from the U.S., but giving them insight national or internationally, because water is so precious overseas. So now we have the drought issue in not only California, but a lot of Western states. We have the cartels on, you know, working on steroids right now and poison cannabis, human trafficking, gun running, synthetic narcotic production. And because COVID's got the nation kind of in crisis, as you and I both know, law enforcement resources are tied up in so many places right now that these wildlife crimes that the cartels are associated with and this water stealing has very little enforcement on it, unfortunately. So they're taking that as a green light to just rip heavy, and we're doing the best we can to hold back the tides. So getting that message out right now is huge. And yeah, I feel like I'm flashback, you know. I was training with my Met unit and the snipers just last Friday in California, and mind-blowing to see what they're under. I felt like, okay, nothing changed. It hasn't slowed down. So sadly, long-windedly, it is a growing problem, and it's something we're going to continue to deal with for many years to come.
Richard Carey, who is the author in That Evil Day, who wrote about the Colebrook murders, where I was shot in the line of duty 24 years ago. But those are things that really stick with you. I tell you, you know, every day I look in the mirror, I can see my scars from that day, and I reflect every day. And this morning, like I told Richard, sitting here reading the book again, you know, hitting the highlights, you know, brings it all back. And I think of, you know, our military and post-traumatic stress syndrome, and I can certainly understand how that affects your lives, and how we really need to help those people that have those issues, because I'm sure I get a little, but compared to what other people have seen, you know, talking to a Vietnam vet not too long ago, he's like, I can't unsee the things I saw. And with this book, Richard, you know, we talked earlier, you put the pieces of the puzzle together, because this book, this whole incident affected the North Country of New Hampshire, North Country of Vermont. And it was a puzzle because there were so many scenes, so many 4 people murdered, 3 people shot. You put the pieces of that puzzle together for me and so many, because we didn't go ask, hey, what were you doing when Carl Drake killed Scott Phillips and Les Lord? We didn't do that. So there was a lot of pieces that weren't put together. And frankly, a lot of people didn't want to talk about it. So those pieces were unhinged until you came up and you did. And I want to compliment you on your investigation for this book, because it was great. It's what it should have been. You got all your background. You talked to all the people, and then you pieced this into a book, which helped all of us understand a lot of what happened, when, where. And I think it was important for the community. It was important for me. And I really appreciate you taking the time, taking the effort, and doing this for an incident that I don't think it would have ever been done had you not stepped up to the plate and done the hard work, the difficult work, the interviews that broke down on. Yeah, it was a tough thing for you to do, but I'm so happy you did it, and I'm so important, just so we could fit the pieces of the puzzle. So welcome to the Warden's Watch, and I appreciate you. This is going to be like a 4-part series. We're going to start with you so you can frame the whole big thing. John's going to do an interview with me. Colonel Jordan's going to chime in, and we're going to finish it up, which I think is really important, with Paula Booth, who's my counselor, for the next year and a half to get me back to where I should be so I could become the game warden that I wanted to be. So that's going to be the series, folks. And but this is the start of it, so you can understand, so you can frame it as well as us. So thank you very much, Richard, and I really appreciate you joining us.
Well, thank you, Wayne. And that sounds like a terrific series, and I'm so glad Colonel Jordan will be involved. He will provide just some terrific input. I'm so glad you approve of the book that came out, because it was terrifying to me to take on subject matter as grave as this and not produce something that rang true and seemed in some way helpful and positive to the community and to the people who were involved. So thanks. That's gratifying to hear.
And Rich, great to have you on the show, like Wayne said before, and get to see you face to face. And I read this book late spring this year. You know, I finally got wind of it, and doing research as Wayne and I, you know, progressed down the podcast path and decided that it was a good time, you know, to obviously a sensitive time for Wayne, having been nearly killed during this officer-involved shooting incident that hurt so many other people. And I was vaguely aware of it. I had started my academy training back in 1992. So I was a brand new game warden out on the West Coast. And we got a little bit of wind on this, but we didn't get enough. You know, and that those were the days that officer-involved shootings and critical incident, traumatic experiences with game wardens, they really weren't shared on a national network from the standpoint of surviving the unthinkable, PTSD issues that come up, what we can do to improve our chances and our will to survive. And so, like Wayne said, I was blown away when I read your book earlier this year on the thoroughness of it and the intensity of it, and being a lifelong investigator and a detective. If you're not writing books, you should be working for us as an investigator in wildlife crimes, because it was exceptionally done. But I got to ask, first and foremost, this thing, like Wayne said, was so multifaceted. You had tragic loss of some state troopers. You had some innocent civilians killed. You had Wayne shot and almost killed, all around this, you know, this Mr. Draga that has just continually, as your book points out, builds up into the erosion of his just acceptance or of humanity, if you will, and just the darkness he kind of shed on everybody. So my first question is, what prompted writing this book, and how'd you come about the idea to bring it together and not only tell the factual stories like an investigation, but backstory, the town, the community, the mindset, you know, the quiet Northwest mountains, what the community is and how close everybody is. And that almost makes it even more devastating, because everybody is so close, unlike an urban environment where it's tragic when we have these mass shootings, but you don't know the stranger that was shot. Everybody knew each other. They were almost family. So a lot of moving parts for you, but what prompted it, if we can go into that?
Sure. Yeah, I remember it came when news of this came across the radio. I was driving along the edge of a lake, Squam Lake, thinking, oh, my God, yeah. This small town, New Hampshire, and just being shocked and astonished. And then, you know, it just kind of went back into a long-term memory, because at that time I was deep into work on The Philosopher Fish, which is my book about the caviar industry and sturgeon conservation and the law enforcement issues involved there. But then, you know, when I finished, by the time I'd finished that book, Columbine had happened out in Colorado, where mm-hmm. some 20 people or something were killed. Mm-hmm. And Virginia Tech. And by that time, it began to be apparent that we were going to suffer a lot more crimes like this. This was going to happen more and more frequently. And also what I noticed with some regret, that it was the perpetrator who was some center stage in all of the mm-hmm. stories about these victims. They were so numerous mm-hmm. that they became just listings in a telephone book. There seemed to be no way to assess the human impact of a crime such as these. But if you look back at the Colebrook incident, the Colebrook murders, you have four people who were murdered there. It's an easier story to tell than a story in which 8 or 12 or 20 or 60 were murdered. Right. It's scaled to such a degree that you can get to know each of the victims. There's space for that. You can get to know the community. There's space for that. It doesn't have to be about the perpetrator. He's got to be one of the major figures, but he doesn't have to be the major figure. Mm-hmm. So it was the scale of the Colebrook story that attracted it to me. And I hadn't done anything like true crime before, but I just had a human curiosity about what is it like for a community to go through something like this? Mm-hmm. Colebrook being something, you know, about the same size as Sandwich, which is where I live in New Hampshire. And I couldn't help wondering what it would be like if something like this happened in Sandwich. So it was a combination of things. It seemed to be an important story. And it seemed to be a story scaled to such a degree that there was room to describe its human impact.
Yeah, no, that's great, Richard. And how did you start by going about, you decided to do this book, and now how do you engage these people, and where did you begin, and how did you start framing the book?
Yeah, I went about it very stupidly. What I did is I just wrote cold, just knock on the door kind of letters to the survivors of Scott Phillips, Les Lord, Vicki Bunnell, and Dennis Jost, just saying, I'd like to do this story and I'd like to have your help. In three of those cases, in a polite way, the door was slammed on my face. We really don't want to do this. But at the Bunnell household, the parents of Vicky, especially her father, Earl, for one thing, he was a great reader. He loved books and admired what books could accomplish. And for a second thing, he was unhappy in one respect about the media coverage of the incident. He thought that too much attention had been paid to Vicky, to the extent that the lives and importance of Dennis Scott and Les didn't receive their full due. And of course, the book that I wanted to do would have lent equal weight to all of those lives and all of those personalities. So that struck a chord with Earl. He and Irene said, well, maybe let's meet and get to know each other a little better. So I went up to Colebrook and had dinner on a couple of occasions with those folks and talked about what sort of shape the book might be. And they said, well, okay, yeah, we will help you with this. And by that time, they had such stature in the community by the generosity of the way they responded and how they had reached out to other victims and other people in the community, that once Earl and Irene were on board with this, then suddenly a number of other people were willing to speak with me as well. It never stopped being a controversial effort because there were two different schools of thought in the community. And one school of thought was, you know, we really need to come to grips with this and have a better understanding of what happened. And another school of thought was, this hurts too much. Let's bury it and forget about it forever and never mention it again. There were people who I would have liked to have talked to who just, couldn't it just talk. Remained too painful yeah. for them. And so their input was never harvested. And that's fine. And there were people who did speak to me and who just broke down. And it was like going through it all over again. Mm-hmm. And I was able to gain an understanding I would never have had before about what PTSD was like. It's just there. It just doesn't heal up entirely.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a... I would say, looking at that time frame, and we talked to Paula Booth about, you know, my counselor, and that's how we used to deal with things. We used to bury them and try not to remember them.
Sure.
But I think we're finding out today, releasing those demons is much better than trying to contain them. And that's hard to tell somebody old school, and it was very new and upcoming to actually speak to a counselor as a police officer. I think, you know, when we started, John, we were supposed to suck it up. But my colonel then was very forward thinking and basically, you know, never made me go, but yeah, he you know how they can make you go and not make you go? It's your decision, but.
Yeah, and Rich, something that's so cool about you taking on this, you know, big challenge of documenting this incident so thoroughly is just what we were just discussing is the cathartic experience for those involved as victims, victims' families, the law enforcement officers involved like Wayne and your state trooper buddies and anybody else that responded to that as a first responder. But today, telling the story is so critical because we've got to get it out there. We got to exercise those demons, as you said, Wayne. And Rich, when you were going through this process, access was certainly an issue as you articulated and certainly understandable, but what were some of the other challenges and what were some of the roadblocks, you know, as you went through the process of writing this and, you know, having written two lengthy nonfiction books and co-authored another one that are isolated, you know, to my experiences primarily, but how they affect an ecosystem, how they affect other officers. It's a tough endeavor to jump into. Especially if you're dealing with one incident that has so many moving parts. So what were some other challenges getting to the finish line and sing for you?
Yeah. One challenge, I guess, was freedom of information. It was very important to access all that was there by way of police reports and documentation on this. So I wrote to the attorney general and asked for, all those reports. And I got some prompt and good help. And I received about 1,000 pages of documentation, which was just sheer gold, all of it. But I remember going down to Fish and Game headquarters to talk to Kevin Jordan down there. He mentioned, you want to get all these reports and you do want to look at those. And I said, yeah, I have. I've got 1,000 pages. And he said, oh, well, there's more than that. And then he took me down into the archives for Fish and Game and showed me all that he had. And it was more like 3,000 pages of material. And I'm wondering, well, oh my God, I've got to see this too, but how am I going to see that? I can't live down here for a month to go through that. He said, well, just take it with you. We'll just load it into the car. Return it when you're done. That level of informality and trust was a godsend, because there were, I don't know why those extra 2,000 pages weren't included in what I received from the Attorney General, but there was material there that was just crucial to understanding what happened in that incident. So certainly, the book could not have been what it is without that wonderful gesture on Kevin Jordan's part. I was able to keep that material for, I don't know, it took 13 years to do the book. So I probably had that material in my closet 5 or 6 years before I returned it to Fish and Game intact. And then another thing was simply the scale of the of an incident with 4 different shooting scenes and so many witnesses and so many people involved immediately or one step removed. 13 years, and I could have devoted another 7 years to really thorough job of getting to everybody who was touched in some way by this. But when Earl Bunnell died in 2013, I believe, without ever having seen the complete manuscript. He saw manuscript pages as I produced them. So he knew what sort of book was taking shape here, but he never got to see the complete thing. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I just pulled the plug on my research and said, I've got to go with the information I have here and just get it out.
Yeah, that's huge. And I mean, look at the good it's done. And you would never know there's any holes or gaps, in the book after reading it, because it is so comprehensive. But yeah, I didn't realize the research period had been so long and that you had to dissect so many documents. And for the agencies to afford that generosity and just give you those sight unseen and say, hey, go do what you need to do with them. There's no time limit. We don't need to keep records. That's kind of unheard of, but it was very fortuitous for this book to even happen, because it sounds like you would not have got the information otherwise, and that 1,000 pages would have been pretty lean on some key components to the investigation.
Oh yes, indeed. Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, Kevin became the MVP of the whole research effort with that gesture, and he himself offered such a great interview, couple of interviews that were just so humane and so generous to the perspectives of other people involved in the incident, which I actually found characteristic of law enforcement throughout. There was no sense of competition between agencies. Mm. It was cooperation and mutual respect all the way through. And I was really impressed. Well, first of all, with how well law enforcement on the whole responded throughout that day, on a day in which no one could communicate very well with each other, on a day in which a whole lot of other people could have been shot unintentionally by law enforcement, but everybody kept their cool and held their fire. And then also by the courage and the generosity of the interviews that I was granted in the aftermath. These were all smart, eloquent, thoughtful men who brought a whole lot of human spirit to the work that they did and who kept it intact in the aftermath.
That's great. And so you got the singular finish line 13 years later. And when the book dropped and it finally was published and it was being distributed, what were some of the initial reactions, not only within the law enforcement circle of all of those involved, Wayne included, and everybody in that those small communities, but what about when this thing went wide? You know, what was the national feedback, and were you getting some surprising comments on maybe the lack of knowledge to this incident, like all of us say on the West Coast? This was a significant incident, and it involved one of our, you know, near and dear thin green liners, Wayne being that guy, and yet we heard nothing on it. You know, and maybe that was a time period, but your book comes out almost a decade and a half later, and things have changed, like we said, as far as how much we share information, how much we learn from other officer-involved shootings and tragic incidences of these mass shootings. What happened with that when it dropped? Tell us that story.
Yeah, the feedback I got from readers was of two different kinds. This is a true crime story, but I did not follow the true crime playbook.
Right.
I gave it a much more literary treatment, focusing a lot on character and history and setting and all of those elements. And then it was kind of packaged as a true crime product by the publisher because they felt that's where the most sales potential lay.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, people who picked it up expecting standard true crime struggled with it a little bit. They found the story to be a little more complicated than they were accustomed to, and sometimes got frustrated trying to follow the different narrative lines.
Sure.
Readers who came to it with a background and interest in literary nonfiction, I got very positive feedback from them, and from all of the reviews that came out, those were all extremely positive. The feedback I got from the community itself was entirely positive and really gratifying and relieving, thank God.
Right.
There was from one reader, a guy in the middle of the incident, when he read the book, he sent me a very angry email about one element in it. In 2002, a book came out by an Arizona newspaper columnist named Vin Suprinowicz. And this was a book called The Ballad of Carl Draga.
Mm.
And it's all about how Draga was a martyr to a tyrannical government and to trigger-happy law enforcement and government weasels who are trying to take away people's sovereign rights. I quoted several times from that book just to demonstrate this other point of view, which I think spoke for itself in terms of how toxic and wrongheaded it was. This was by a guy who never visited Colebrook and who never talked to any of the witnesses or survivors and who never read any of the police reports. He just had a certain agenda he wanted to advance with this story. So anyway, this reader was angry that I had given any sort of on-air time to that sort of perspective. But you know, we agreed to disagree about that. I think it was important to show that just so that we're all aware that there is that perspective out there, that someone can look at this story and feel that Pearl Carl Drago was the victim here and not the four people that he murdered.
Yeah, it's we see a lot of that these days. When you have that template of somebody that doesn't act so heinous or a group of people that do an act so heinous. And that is, you know, it ebbs and flows, especially in, you know, some of these more, I don't know, I'm not going to say maybe militant's the wrong word, maybe prepper, because Wayne and I have done a lot on the thin green line with preparedness and, you know, this kind of thing. But the bottom line is innocent people were killed innocent people were threatened, law enforcement that had no connection with this guy. Bottom line, Wayne being, you know, one of those guys, you know, were impacted severely, fatally in some cases. And I want to empathize with you, author to author of nonfiction, true crime type books. I went into the same, what I loved about your book, and I want to highlight what we talked about in the beginning, is the characterization and building up who these folks were in the community. Even when I started to read it, I kind of went, wow, you know, this is not a typical true crime book. This is not, you know, the investigation you must have done for this. This is not playing out like building up the facts, getting to the shootouts, getting to the aftermath, getting to the responding agencies, how the community, it was a breath of fresh air for me, because I too, in War in the Woods and Hidden War, really overemphasized the characters and details of people, whether they be teammates on the tactical team, whether they be the public, whether they be wildlife, whatever the case may be. And as an example, Hidden War was about 70 pages longer than the final product the public sees now, because I went crazy on character, and my editors, you know, they said, hey, we love it all, but man, we got to get to the meat, man. We got to get to the meat, you know? And I'm sure you've heard that. But I think true crime lacks that. And I know I'm going off tangent from the incident itself, but the bottom line that makes a good true crime book so good is emphasizing everybody involved, getting into the mindset of Draga, getting into the mindset of those officers, Wayne, getting into the mindset of Bonnie and Earl and everybody else in that community. It just makes it so much more real. And I think we as readers can paint that individual picture we do in our heads, not seeing this on a TV screen especially, but we can empathize with the situation, with the people, so much better when it's there. And I wish we'd see more of it. So kudos to that part of the book. But it was not traditional, and I feel your pain a little bit. I had some editor chops that I know had to happen, but I'll always have those drafts of those chapters, you know, always saved and go, hey, if it ever comes back and we need to expand, you got to have that, you know. It just makes it real, brings it in. So yeah, good, nice work there.
Thank you. Yeah, and as long as In the Evil Day is, it was, you know, it's about 300 pages longer in the first draft.
I'll bet. Yeah, I hear you for sure.
Wow. And Draga was kind of the first. I always, when I refer to him, it's the free stater, the sovereign citizen type of person. And he was kind of the first one to make a national statement, so to speak. And I think that's why those other people gravitate towards him.
Yeah. And ironically, he was not himself a member, you know, that we know of anyway, not himself a member of any militia or organized political group that way. He was pretty much a lone wolf. But at some point, he began signing his correspondence, a sovereign citizen. I think there were certain flirtations there between him and some paramilitary groups in the North Country. And then in 1997, yeah, this was big news, you know, national news. This was international news. It went all over the world because this was just something that didn't happen much often in America then, least of all in rural New Hampshire.
Right.
So yeah, it's in the aftermath that Draga has become a public figure to these groups out there on the fringe. And, you know, I still give talks on this book and on this incident to various libraries and historical societies. And I'm still kind of doing the math on shooting incidents like this. And, you know, so if you want to define a mass shooting incident as something in which four or more people are killed or wounded, as of June 21st this year, there were 293 of such incidents in the nation. And just on that weekend of June 21st, there were 10 on that weekend. So, you know, we hear about these frequently on the news, but we have reached a point where there isn't near enough room for all of them. Sure. Something like 90-95%, never a ripple anymore in the media world, because there's just too many.
Well, and that figure's mind-blowing, Rich, honestly. You know, I mean, I follow this. Wayne follows this. We see this on the news. I hear about it, you know, happening in my old agency. And, you know, I hear about it happening with allied agencies all over the U.S. But we don't really count the number and document it that way. And 293 sounds higher than I would have guessed, by at least double, with what we've been exposed to, even on the inside track. So that's not only alarming, but it definitely shows that this is a pervasive problem nationally and something we got to continue to try to remedy and have the support networks in and when they happen around everything from PTSD to victim support to active shooter allied agency response. I know from a law enforcement training standpoint, especially on the tactical side where I've been involved in, the biggest thing I was facing other than small unit operations against the cartels was active shooter engagements. And training not only to a certain tactical level as a game warden agency, but integrating with other urban law enforcement teams, rural law enforcement teams at the local level, state and federal, knowing that when these things happen, we could be anywhere in the country and all of a sudden we're all going to be pulled together into this melting pot and we could be from 20 different agencies. And let's just hope we have similar training and we have the mindset to go in and do what we need to do when that critical time consideration is such an issue that we can't hesitate. We got to go in and stop the threat and minimize the casualties, if you will. And it's probably one of the biggest challenges for law enforcement today, because it's one of the most dangerous things we do that we don't really plan for in our day-to-day, or we're not really doing day-to-day operationally within our agencies, but it's become a huge, huge issue. Fortunately, some of the smaller agencies aren't quite trained to that level that they should be to be effective and to be safe if they respond to one of these. So numbers like that, I think, wake up anybody on the administrative side that these are happening everywhere. And they're, you just said it, 10 happened on the very weekend on the 21st of June and around that. And that's mind blowing. So we kind of need to be prepared for that and good information to have.
Yeah. Richard, could you go through the whole incident? Cause when we were going to focus on the game warden incident, but I like everybody to go into the continuing podcast, knowing actually what happened in a general type of thing from the beginning through the end, not in so much detail as your book goes into, or that we'll
good,
go
but a good overview. Yeah, yeah, certainly a good overview.
Yeah, and we're going to go deep into my incident, and then Colonel Jordan, and as well as my counselor, which I think is really key and important to wrapping up an incident like this, that to help others that have a similar incident or just a critical incident in their family and know how to deal with things. But just to give our listeners to know what everything is without grabbing your book and doing the read, but maybe, get the book after you hear this podcast so you can get those details into it as well.
Sure. Yeah. So, okay. 5-minute version of the train of events, something like that then?
Yeah.
Absolutely. That'd be great. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So, Carl Draga, he lives in central New Hampshire, but he buys a cabin for retirement in the North Country on the banks of the Connecticut River. And he gets into a dispute with the local zoning authorities about the construction of a barn on that. And this is 1972, and this escalates over 25 years into a series of disputes between Draga and local government, Draga and state government agencies, Draga and local law enforcement, Draga versus his contractors, Draga versus his neighbors. He just becomes increasingly angry and confrontational about everything over time. And one day in August 19th, 1997, shortly after having threatened the life of Vicki Bunnell, who was a small town lawyer, a selectman in the town of Columbia, and Vicki was the person who had called the police and had Draga arrested on two incidents that became where Draga threatened to become violent. And so Draga had a particular hostility towards Vicki, even though it had been years since she was on the Board of Selectmen. Anyway, he had made this threat So on this afternoon, State Trooper Scott Phillips decides to pull Draga over and talk about that threat he had made against Vicky. Draga pulls into a supermarket north of Colebrook. He steps out of the pickup with an AR-15 rifle, and before any conversation, opens fire on Scott. Scott flees into high grass on the edge of the parking lot just as Les Lord, another state trooper called for backup, arrives, turns the rifle on Les's cruiser and kills Les almost instantly. Then he follows, finds where Scott is in the high grass. Scott is out of ammunition, unable to reload. He executes Scott, climbs into Scott's cruiser, and leaves the parking lot. A couple of municipal officers have arrived by then, but they didn't know it was a shooting incident, or no, they didn't know what kind of incident it was. They're outgunned and are unable to approach Draga, unable to contain him in the parking lot. Draga drives to the News and Sentinel newspaper building in downtown Sentinel, where Vicky Bunnell has her office. Vicky sees Draga climb out of the cruiser with his rifle. She calls out a warning. Everybody runs out of the newspaper office out the back door. Someone, as a precaution, had locked the front door of the building. So Draga goes around to the back and sees people fleeing out the back just as he arrives at the parking lot. He sights on Vicky and guns her down. Dennis Jose, the newspaper editor, who's coming out the back door as that happens. He is a lifelong pacifist, conscientious objector during the Vietnam War, but he can't stand this, and he tackles Draga, attempts to take the rifle away from him. He loses that struggle. Draga stands over him, fires several rounds into Dennis, and he dies later at the Upper Connecticut Valley Hospital. Draga returns to his cruiser and drives south to Columbia to his cabin, dons a ballistics vest, loads a lot of ammunition into the cruiser, shaves his beard off, attempts to burn down the barn. He does succeed in burning down, setting fire to his cabin. Wow. He drives down Route 3 into past Columbia and into Stratford, New Hampshire, where there is a bridge into Vermont, crosses that bridge. It is at that point that a young fish and game officer, Wayne Saunders, finds him. As far as Wayne knows, this is a stolen cruiser incident. He has no word that there's been any gunfire. So Wayne puts on his blue lights, pursues across the bridge into Vermont, starts to follow down Route 202 under a railroad trestle, but notices that the cruiser is not, he doesn't see the cruiser on the other side of the trestle. In fact, Draga is pulled off to the side, jumps out from behind the trestle, fires a number of rounds into Wayne's cruiser. And the only reason Wayne is on this broadcast is because of the badge he was wearing that day, which deflects one of Draga's bullets into his arms, and he nearly dies from the damage inflicted by that. Draga continues down Route 202 and disappears off into a side road, sets up an ambush there. The cruiser is eventually located, a detachment sent in to take charge of the cruiser, which has apparently been abandoned, but in fact, it's an ambush. Six men would have died there had not a dog called out a warning. Two were wounded in the fire from up the slope, but eventually Draga was killed in the ensuing shootout. Two officers were badly wounded, but there were no subsequent deaths. Meanwhile, back at the News and Sentinel, those survivors there are getting the newspaper out onto the sidewalk the next day, giving us the first account of this incident.
Wow.
Thank you.
That's a lot in a little, man, before we go into details on the next interviews. That was that was heartbreaking, powerful, and concise. Wow. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it was definitely, and you know, for the listeners to listen. And I thought about how to do a podcast to include all of those incidents. And I, like you said, there was so much that where do you start and where do you end and who do you talk to? And, you know, it was kind of mind-boggling for me. So I'm like, I'll focus on me. But we got to let our listeners know what happened for the totality. And that's when it came to mind in that evil day. Does exactly like that. It put all the pieces of the puzzle together for me and for a lot of people I know that, you know, when they read the book, they were like, oh, I didn't know that happened. Oh, I didn't know that happened. Because everybody almost in the North Country for sure knows where they were that day. It's almost like a 9/11 incident where you remember where you were in 9/11 for the North Country. That moment. They remember.
All through New Hampshire. I'd say that's true all through New Hampshire. I'd go all over the state. And people would remember where they were when they heard about this.
Mm. Yeah, so it was that 9/11 moment for us, and that's how I can describe it, because people always would come up to me and tell me what was going on when they heard it or that day, and they could relate to it. And some people, you know, it was just amazing where they were in proximity to it, that they saw the cruiser, things like that when it was stolen. And the lack of communication that day, we're going to talk about that in mine. But and then the good things that came out of it, because I always like to focus on good things that actually came out with the better communications, the better weapons that we were able to get because of that incident. There's always good that comes out of bad. I just it is tough to lose friends.
Mm. Yeah, and speaking of the good, I knew going in that this was going to be a sad, sad story, but I could not anticipate all of the uplift and inspiration I would find by discovering with how much courage and how much grace people responded, who, you know, all of a sudden gunfire breaks out and they find themselves in a war zone. So, you know, just not just the law enforcement people, but bystanders and EMTs and the various ways people rush to help each other and to protect each other and in the aftermath to support each other. It restores a lot of your faith in human nature and lifts it higher.
No. Yeah, and it really does, and especially in these darker incidents, this one, you know, on the forefront. And did you notice, Rich and Wayne, this is a question, you know, really for any of you guys involved, that I would imagine there was an even tighter knit bond within the community, especially where the incidents were taking place many, many years later. I know, I mean, there's always the tragedy. I think about when my partner Warden was shot in 05 and almost died and luckily survived that on a cartel cannabis raid, Rich, that was my first shooting incident of about six. And I remember going through that day, as I'm sure Wayne can attest, of not knowing if he was going to survive and the officers we did lose and the civilians we lost during this particular situation. And you feel kind of hopeless, definitely, and especially in the shock of the immediacy of it and the aftermath is, where do we go next? You know, especially as a small community, how do we get past this? But time does heal, certainly to a large extent over a duration, but also just the bonds of people coming together that really helped save lives that day. You talk about, you know, your conscientious objector in the back of the print, and coming out of the back and at least tried. Doesn't always turn out right. I think of Flight 93 during 9/11 and that group of passengers that said, we're not having it. We know we're not going to make it, but we're not going to take out more lives on the ground. That to me, guys, is one of the most inspiring things about the human condition, about the selflessness we can find in a pretty selfish world and willing to lay our lives on the line and know we're going to lose our lives, but other people might live that we don't even know. And it's not always happening from first responders and sheepdogs in our world of professionalism where we're geared to do that. This is coming from your everyday Joe Blow citizen that hasn't chosen this line of work, but they just have that protective instinct for their community. And you said it well, Rich, that's the hope we have, you know, and I think your book
and we get to the characterization of really going into who the victims were, paint that picture of hope. And we need to have more stories like this. And moving forward, I know we, of course, we got to talk about where people can get your book, you know, any type of blogs on it, how they can comment on it. Cause this is, it's an incident that's historically dated a little bit, certainly. But like you said, it's one of the very first, if not the first, shootings of this type that, you know, just rocked a small rural community that so many of us live in.
Yeah, Rich, I think John described Dennis Jost to a T. He was the hero. He didn't get paid to put a gun on, to put a badge on. In some way, we accept that we could be hurt in the line of duty, killed in the line of duty by taking that oath. Vicky Bunnell didn't take that. Dennis Jost, like you said, didn't take that. But he was the ultimate hero that day, the guy that John just described, the guy that wasn't going to take it, you know, and a pacifist during the Vietnam War. It broke him for him to be a hero that day. I think we all wish that, you know, he was the winner of that fight for sure. But I always think when I talk about this incident, Dennis Jost was a hero in every which way. And that's what I see out of that, because he was never asked to do that. He did it, especially with his background, to rise to the occasion, to do what he could. Is just, boy, you just described that, John. You described Dennis Jost talking about those people. I had to say.
And it just, and you know, I look at it and it's, when you guys are so close to it, it's hard to, you know, necessarily see it. And I'm looking at this as an outsider coming in, obviously sharing a great profession that we were blessed to share, Wayne, and Rich, to write stories that, you know, are nonfiction and might help somebody that aren't always pretty. You know, you wrote a heck of a one, and I've had the privilege of doing a couple myself on our experiences. But the bottom line is, that's America to me, is what Dennis did. It really is. And this was way before 9/11, but the incident we just talked about on Flight 93 was something that I think started to get in our nation's mind of, we're not taking it. You know, and we can't always rely on first responders and law enforcement, given the small percentage of numbers, to save the day when the proverbial, you know, crap hits the fan. We just can't. We have to step up and we have to do those hard calls, and we can't just be victims and sit back and be part of the casualty list. And I think, you know, maybe take some fire away from these mass shooting suspects that go out with a weapon and do something heinous and think that they're just going to, you know, get away with it necessarily before law enforcement shows up. And certainly, looking at today's world and COVID and everything is self sustenance and having to look after ourselves, when a 911 call might not lead to any help for hours, if not at all, even in the biggest cities where crimes are going crazy. And Rich, I'm sure you can attest to this with all the knowledge and data you're still getting on these type of incidents, that we can't always rely on law enforcement, and it's the everyday citizen hero that can make or break the difference, like Dennis did that day for sure.
Yeah, and you know, he was he was in his early 50s, but very fit. He might have won that battle, but he had been up on his roof a few days before and taken a tumble off of it, and had hurt his back, and he was limping badly that day. But even with that injury, he threw himself into that, and you just have to stand in awe.
Yeah, another fact I didn't know, Rich, was that he had taken a tumble. And, you know, John says, you know, from the outside looking in, and that's the way you started, but you became an insider. You actually, you know, peeled back the layers of the onion and became emotionally attached, felt their pain. And I think John pointed that out when he said, from an outsider looking in. And then I just realized that you were an outsider looking in, but you became an insider in a big way. And this incident affects you as much as it does me.
Yeah, I've read about war correspondents who suffer from PTSD, mm-hmm. even though, you know, they're not handling weapons or doing, and it's, you know, and they may not even have been in combat, but it's just the stories they hear and that they relay. And yeah, I can see how that happens. I feel like Scott and Les were brothers. and that Vicky was a sister, and that Dennis was a brother. And I just grieve these people. And yeah, when I go out and give the talks that I still give on this incident, the tears are still there. I have a hard time getting through sometimes.
Yeah, I can imagine, Rich, and it really comes out to those, you know, we talk about the character descriptions. We can tell how close you were to everybody involved in this incident, just in how you describe the personal side of them that you wouldn't normally get in an investigation. And when you're just talking about the nuts and bolts of what went down and who was lost and who survived and what the aftermath was. So tough run for you, buddy. And we feel for you for sure of being part of it.
Yeah, but a hero in the same thing to dive into this and to write this, knowing that, you know, you were going to get both good and bad impact, and being a friend with Earl, and Earl, I'm sure, encouraging you along the way to write this book when you had your doubts. You know, the cover of it is actually my shooting incident, the scene at my shooting incident, which is every time I look at it, I brought my son there to show him. I used to bring trainees there and show them and talk it through. The only time I had a really hard time talking about the incident was the International Wildlife Crime Stoppers conference, and I broke down then, and I think it's because I hadn't talked about it in a while. I hadn't relieved that stress. You know, in a while, and it ain't, you know, it was been boiling up inside, and it came out. It was tough, but I think it's good for me to talk about it. It's good to be talked about, I believe. And then I look at the day that they put up the little flags there that had the numbers of how many rounds were on the ground there. My badge, actually, the center of my badge got knocked off that day, and they didn't figure out why the seal of New Hampshire was there, but it was the center of my badge. I had been knocked off and was underneath there. Yeah, for sure. And then just reading it, you know, it was very game warden heavy. There was a field day, and we'll get into this, John, but one of the other first responders was a Vermont game warden. And just to have him look at my cruiser there and say he didn't think I made it, just looking at the cruiser and the amount of rounds that it took and where they were taken.
Hammered. Yeah, how extensive the attack had been, man. And God, very blessed. I'm glad you're here, buddy. Yeah. After diving into this and seeing the extent of it. But Rich, we're promoting your book because this is a story that has to get told. It is timeless. I was, like I said, I was blown away with the comprehensiveness of it. Where can people find it, and how can they reach out to you for questions, for you know, speaking engagements, et cetera? How can we reach you and get a hold of that book?
Sure. You can reach me through my website, www.richardadamscarey.com.
Okay.
And I also have a website for the book, intheevilday.com.
Gotcha. Okay.
So either of those will work. And the book can be obtained from Amazon or from any online retailer. But I particularly encourage you to go to your local bookstore. And if it's not there in the shelves, simply ask them to order it. And that will help to support local booksellers. And it's available at many libraries as well.
Yeah, that would be great. I actually got it on Amazon as a Kindle because I was doing so much traveling and teaching myself, and I dissected at that. But I'd be honored to have a signed hard copy of that book from you. And certainly, if you like, send over a copy. I'll send you some signed copies of mine because this one's a special one, man. And now that we've been face to face, and I've seen another active, you know, hero in the story. And thank you so much for putting the story out. Great book. And we highly recommend it.
Yeah.
And thank you, John. I'm fascinated to see your work as well. So yeah, let's do that swap. That would be great.
Well, you bet. I'll reach out to you after, and we'll make it happen. And thanks so much.
I got one final question for you, Richard. The name of the book, how'd that come about? Because I know we all put a lot of work into our names on our book. At least John, I know, has. I just came out with a children's book. So that's, names of books are really important and usually have a backstory.
Yeah, well, the original title for it was Their Town.
Their Town.
A purposeful allusion to Our Town, which is another story about the effects of tragedy in a small New Hampshire town. So I liked making that connection. My publisher didn't think there was enough sizzle to that. So we chose In the Evil Day, finally, which comes from the Bible. And it's a passage from St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians. And it's about the importance of being on your guard, because at any moment in the evil day, the principalities that support evil shall beset you. And that passage was quoted by the pastor of the Congregational Church in Colebrook during Vicky's memorial service on the weekend after the shootings. So I felt it was a nice, apt quotation that would work well as the title.
Yeah, it's a great title. It grips you, and the depth of it, I think, especially spiritually for all of us, is spot on. Great choice.
No, thank you so much, Richard, for joining us and talking about this and starting our four-part series, because I think it's going to be informative and engaging and let people know. I think a lot of us that get in shooting incidents or criminal incidents, we don't like people to forget, because we never do. So thank you so much.
Thank you. So glad you're doing this.
Yep. Thanks, Rich. It's been a real honor and a pleasure to meet you and see you firsthand, and really enjoyed the book. And thanks for all you're doing. Hope to talk again.
Thank you, John. And I'm honored as well. Look forward to hearing from you.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.